Hello and welcome to Royale Without Cheese, our bi-weekly podcast in which we discuss both the classic and the unknown of art and popular cinema from the then and now. We are your hosts, me, Miguel Aydo, Tomás Ferreira.
Hey, hey, hey.
Hi there. And Leonardo Miranda.
Hey, guys.
Today we talk about After Hours, but before any ado, don't forget to subscribe, leave a comment, or simply give us a like. After Hours is a 1985 dark comedy film directed by Martin Scorsese and written by Joseph Mannion. Griffin Dunne stars as Paul Hackett, an office worker who experiences a series of nighttime misadventures while attempting to make his way home from New York City's shady Soho district. The last feature by Scorsese not to be an adaptation or biopic, After Hours was critically acclaimed for its humor, winning the Independent Spirit Award for Best Feature and the Best Director Award at Cannes. All great praise for this night ride of crazy artsy schmoes around one poor Joe, but the question is, did the Moes at Royale find this one to be a night to remember? Fellas, what do we think?
Boom. Okay, we would first like to thank our one follower who suggested this episode for this review, like you guys at home can do, Lina Costa, and one other follower who really liked this movie, Mark Silva. So, shout out to them.
Shout out.
So, After Hours, here we go. Another collaboration with Michael Bauhaus, this time with Martin Scorsese, which he said was a dream, you know, was a dream to collaborate with Martin after Fassbinder, because it was just burned. I think he made a lot of films, you know. I mean, he made 40, like I said, 40 features in a short amount of time. But yeah, going to After Hours.
Was it the first time for you? I know, Tomas, you already
Not
watched
it.
Yeah. You suggested it to me, actually, back then.
This was the first time I watched After Hours.
Yeah. I mean, After Hours, at the time that I watched it, I thought at the time, this might be my favorite of him. I mean, over time, I reevaluated that positioning of my favorite from Martin Scorsese, but still, it's one of those. It just took me by surprise completely, being a comedy from Martin Scorsese, a dark one. And the way the film develops, I mean, it provoked anxiety in me at the time. It's kind of a modern Kafkaesque tale in a way.
You can't read the trial.
Yeah, exactly. I can't deal with bureaucracy. But
Funnily enough, I read it. I read something that there's a scene where Paul is entering the Berlin Club.
Yeah. It's from the trial. It's the
story. Yeah, which quotes sort of a parable from Kafka, yeah. And I actually read it in a German class because it was a short, it's a parable, so it's a very
it's
short
called
text.
Before the Law.
Yeah. And I read that in the German version. And it's very interesting because then, you rewatch the scene and you see it exactly basically where they took the lines from. It's very, it's cool.
Yeah, because it's
How
pretty
specific.
Much the exact same wording, at least from what I remember. Even though
I'll
take your
really
money
changing.
Just so you don't know, so you don't think that you left everything untried. So it's like a very specific word that he uses. It's like very good. Yeah, I liked it a lot more now. Yeah, I watched it the first time more than that, a bunch of years ago. I liked it at the time. I just didn't really get into the flow of it. But this time I was having a blast. It's such a crazy narrative that I think it's also what Tomas was saying. It's sort of unexpected from Scorsese, this type of film that almost reminds me a bit of a Coen Brothers black comedy, that type of thing.
That's a very good comparison, yeah.
It's very interesting. It's, again, it's rooted in the character wanting something. And this time, like, first he wants sex and then he wants to go home. He just wants to go home and he can't. And it's like, it's very... It's frustrating even for you. It's like, why can't this guy go home?
Yeah, I mean, I think, it's interesting the comparison with the Coens, because even though, it's similar, the Coens always have kind of a realism, a groundedness to their films. And in here, after a while, kind of get this sort of sense of surrealism. Maybe not surrealism, but a sense of irrealism where... Yeah,
it's like
this
absurdism.
Clearly is work. Yeah, absurdism. It clearly leaves the stage of being grounded and becomes something else that you just have to go for it, and it's kind of like a ride. Just embrace the chaos and the improbabilities, and just take it as a comedy and an absurdist comedy. And I think once you there's a Well, it's not immediate because, you know, for a long time the film is kind of coherent and probable and realistic. But after a while, you just have to click when it becomes kind of, okay, how can this still be happening to this guy? You know, I just took it for a ride, and I really enjoyed the film. But because, you know, you're capable of doing that, if you get too caught up in the specific things that are happening and how everyone comes together again, it's okay. You won't really enjoy the film as much.
Yeah, because narratively you do feel like there's moments where you feel like people are doing things or things are happening more because it's supposed to happen in the narrative, or it's like to keep adding up and piling up just unfortunate events for this guy. So I think when I first watched, that was a bit of why I didn't really love it. I felt the narrative construction too much. But now on a rewatch, it's like that's part of what makes it so interesting to watch. It's that the absurdity of the things that keep happening. And it's gradual enough, I think. The film in the beginning starts suggesting like that things are a little off tonight, and you know, the dollar bill flies away. Even his interaction with Marcy, yeah, in the coffee shop, it's like weird. So from the get-go, you get a sense that things are not really normal in this world, and then it just keeps going and going and going until it's just chaos, and then he's dropped, and back to the office you go.
That was amazing. When I think of this movie, I always think about the ending. I always think about
Yeah.
that shot of him falling off the van and from a statue becoming man again and just completely dirty going into the office again. It's like a Kafka nightmare. There's no way he
There
has a
were a
home.
few
It's just the
seconds there
office.
where he was trapped there in the basement, where it was kind of like a horror film. Like, okay, this is turning into a psycho's basement den or something. I mean, wow.
Truly. Yeah, it's very interesting that you say that at first, you know, this absurdist aspect of the film was what put you off. Because how can this all pile up and do this horrible night for this guy? But for me, it was so much grounded in realism from the beginning, from my first watch to my second watch, that I never put it kind of into question. And it's so well done in that way. And what I found particularly interesting about the film in its poetry about the character and the other characters is that Paul is kind of this guy who wants to be a protagonist, break out of the grind of his daily job, and that is very well established through the mastery of point of view, subjective point of view that Martin Scorsese has, we've discussed in other reviews of ours, can clearly express in many different ways, from clear term point of view shots to other suggestions in his editing with Thelma. But in here, it's like the loneliness of the character, and this is what's so kind of poetic about the film in its specific way. The loneliness of the character is the same loneliness that for me the other characters are going through, and it's what makes them over time into these weirdos. You know, he's no different from the other weirdos. He's just coming off late to the party, but he's going to become one of them, and that is couldn't be any clearer when he gets invited eventually after so many encounters to that K-man's apartment, and he's trying to have it off with him like a one-night stand, just the same way Paul was trying to have a one-night stand with Marcy, this girl he just met, and he just cuts everything off because he has these ideas in his head that he needs to express, and he went off. That's exactly what the other character did to him. So you end up with this. That's how the awkwardness of the film is born out of. All of these characters are lonely and they want companionship, including Paul, but also the waitress that just, you know, gets off her job, quits, and wants to celebrate, or Marcy, who her idea of a date is not going, you know, to bed, is just actually venting and having a shoulder to cry on. But the other person wants none of it. So they want every each of these characters, including Paul, want companionship on their own terms. When there's a mismatch, like a lack of like compatibility in those terms, that's where the awkwardness of the film comes in. And it's basically a cycle of that logic throughout all these encounters. And like, it's very interesting to see the expectations not met in these people towards what they think that this encounter is. And it's always on repeat on those terms. You know, you have like, and those are like the weird situations, you know, are born from. Like, for example, you have
But it's because it goes overboard that you accept it so well, I think, because it clearly like assumes that these are the same people always reappearing, and of course, in that that's part of why it's a comedy. I mean, but ultimately, it's because it fully goes into that territory, that you kind of have so much fun watching it.
Yeah,
And
yeah,
even
yeah.
though you realize the construction, you know that they did it very purposefully, and so it becomes a
Yeah,
very joyful
definitely.
experience. Yeah.
And it's the way that, like, the mismatch between what they think companionship is and what they think that date is going to be. For every time that Paul meets with Marcy or the waitress or that ice cream truck woman, what they think this encounter is, that mismatch, is what kind of provokes this awkwardness and who the characters are, how it falls off, like you say. It's so incredibly absurd because of their personalities. The waitress wants some kind of encounter. She wants to play psychiatrist. Tell me about your feelings while I draw you. It's just, I think not. It's just absurd. She thinks that this encounter is something while he just wants the phone. He just wants, a place to hide from the rain. And that mismatch is incredible. And then, just to talk about the beginning, I think it's so interesting how, his stages, to talk a little bit about the setup of the character of Paul in that office. Without saying much, the way he expresses the point of view of Paul and the desires of Paul, without saying much, is super interesting. It just puts the viewer really on par with the emotion and the intention of the character without saying absolutely anything or very little. You have at the office, he's teaching that intern fellow who then says, I don't really want to do this. I want to be a magazine editor. And just through his look, he looks around to that sea of people working at the office, the paper clippings, the clogs in the machine that they all are. And that he becomes disappointed. He falls off from this place of being, kind of an inspiring figure, mentor, just being a nothingness. And you see him at his like lonely flat trying to get something going on at night. And eventually he meets Marcy. And the way that that scene is staged is kind of very interesting. The point of view scenario is she's not seen through her eyes. We see her from an over-the-shoulder perspective, her over the shoulder. She says something, "What book are you reading? I've read that book." And only then he notices her. He goes near her ta his table, and the camera is still like almost like in a video game perspective, over the shoulder to her. To him, she's not a mystery, but to us, the viewers, she is this mystery girl. Who is this girl? Why is she going into him? And then, Marcy sits down and she says that thing, which is, "Dude, have you noticed that waiter?" And the waiter is like dancing in his workplace. And so there's this, like the dollar bill that you said, Leo, there's this progressive suggestion that this world is a little bit offbeat and we're being introduced to this, world of artsy schmoes who are a little bit quirky. And Paul is just this kind of white-collar worker who comes into the situation and very much does not belong here. It's like Martin Scorsese told in a conversation with Franz Lebowitz. He's just that guy who is in the room full of people. Everybody's looking at him. He thinks he knows what everybody's talking about, but actually they're looking at him because you don't belong here, mate. It's like that scene where he mentions that scene where, certainly Kiki Bridges, the artist, is tied up. He goes into the room, into the apartment, and he starts untying her up. He has this narrative in his head that there were burglars, they stole from her, they tied her down, and they're like, "What is this?
They're
They're sailor
sailors.
knots, It's just like a sadomasochistic play. So yeah, it's very interesting how the film like really conjures his point of view. And later on, when he's actually having the date with Marcy and goes to his apartment, I mean, very much like the other people who lure him, well, he actually asks for shelter and he goes to their apartments, to the waitress apartments, to the ice cream truck woman apartment. He's asking for something. "I want a phone. I want this. Do you have a phone?" He's on a completely different wavelength and he thinks they are on his wavelength, but they are not. They start just telling about their day, their life story, whatever. And it's not. And it's A and B communication. That's just how life happens. Sometimes people are on completely wavelengths, thinking they're having the same conversation, but they're not. And that's what happens to Paul in the beginning, really. He thinks that what Marcy's telling him is going to be a night to remember. All these sexual innuendos are going to happen, but then they don't. And the things he himself says to Marcy, he thinks, there's this idea that, he's the one truthful character, he's the one honest character, but he's just as much, mismatched, up in the air, let's say, as the other characters are. Like every time he gives a lukewarm answer to the pains and hurdles of Marcy at the beginning, when she's talking about her 6-hour rape, that she had in the middle of the night, and he's acting up as if he, of course, he is concerned, of course, he empathizes, but to a very basic level. you know, and it's like, oh yeah, that's too bad, you know, can we have sex, you know? Because on the one hand you're having all these innuendos of him looking the other way to the apartment next door, and there are, you know, the couple having sex, you know, and you have the tick tock of the clock kind of, come on, come on, and let's jump to this thing that I want, you know. You know, so you're very inside his anxieties and his desire, and he's completely not on par with the other person. So, you know, it's interesting how at the beginning of the film he seems like the straight guy, but then as you look in retrospective, he's not very much different from the other people. You know, he's kind of, he has these fake responses, like he understands them, but in actuality, they're all just on different wavelengths, really. And it's very interesting, that rape scene, because, you know, he sits down and it's very cruel in a comedy, hence the term dark comedy. You know, she sits down, suddenly she's kind of on a date talking about this 6-hour rape. And there's the adding thing that he's starting to think about, oh, what does she have? You know, what the burns, scars, you know, he sees that scar on her leg. You know, her friend talked about scars. So there's always these sexual teases, you know, he massages Kiki Bridges, which I thought, oh my God, this is so cringe. But then she falls asleep on him. And then there's this scene in the bed, you think it's gonna happen, but then sex rape talk. And it's like, you feel bad for her, but only you feel bad for him because just of the expectations that he had for, like, finally a night to remember or something. You know, I'm gonna have a break, but then that doesn't happen. Yeah,
I mean,
so
it's so well
yeah.
done how you can connect with him, even though you know that it's kind of up
He
in the
has
air,
shallow
and
intents, yeah.
yeah, so that's kind of one of the brilliant points of the film is that you can see him deteriorating, and you can really understand how it's affecting him, and you empathize with him, but you never cease to understand how he's kind of arrogant and shallow and unemotional and unempathetic, I
Unavailable
think.
emotionally, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
He kind of wanted that for himself, Marcy, to be so ready to perform this function of, you know, let's have this one night stand. But then when everybody wants a response from him, he's like, no, I need to get home. And it's very interesting because you totally understand the guy. You want to fucking get home because you've been there raining fucking shit, you know, you need to get home. But at the same
Even that
time,
sort of arc that he goes through, where the office scene in the beginning kind of with the disappointment kind of forces him to go out and have a one night stand and becomes all loose. But then with all the things that are happening with him, he just kind of completely lets go of that and just wants to go home. So I think it's really interesting how he just completely gives in and his objective becomes so mundane, so trivial as just to go back home. And even that he can't achieve, so. And another thing we kind of went through, which as is, because it's a comedy, you go through these games of the expectations, and I think Scorsese does this so well in so many cases where he always teases you with a certain scenario, which then turns out to be something else, like when Kiki is tied up and you realize it's this sort of sexual fantasy fetish thing. And then where Marcy is asleep and then he's talking and giving this whole speech, but then she's actually dead already. So there's always this play on the scenarios and what you think is happening versus
yeah.
what is actually happening. It's done so well in so many scenes. And this guy, this Griffin dude, never seen him
Griffin.
anything else.
Yeah,
It's so
he
weird.
looks like Charlie Sheen a little bit.
Yeah,
Yeah,
he has a
yeah.
very familiar face.
Yeah,
Yeah,
he
he
has
has
a
I know him from other
very.
movies like Werewolf in London. I've known for ages, never watched
I have
that
never
movie, but
seen
it's a
it, yeah.
very classic horror movie. And then
Usually.
of course the Madonna film, Who's That Girl? I've seen him briefly, and
Never
but
seen.
this was the one I've, you know, watched fully, the Hesse
But
film.
interesting, like there's two Madonna 80s screwball films, and they're both connected to this film because Rosanna Arquette,
Is
who is
also
Marcy, is also in a film with her, which is
right.
Desperately Seeking Susan. And the other is with Griffin Dunne, which is the one I hadn't heard of that one, which is called, what did you say it was the name?
Who's that girl?
Who's that girl? So.
I think she has a music made for the film, perhaps, yeah.
Probably.
She's very good in this film, Roseanne. Very
Rosanna.
good
Yeah,
role.
very, very, very.
Rosanna.
Overall,
I think everyone is very good.
the performances are all very,
Yeah.
very good. And isn't Isn't John Hurt also with Catherine O'Hara in Home Alone? Aren't they the
Exactly.
parents?
Yeah,
yeah, it's
exactly.
yeah,
They're
yeah.
the
It's true.
parents
It's
of
true.
Home
Yeah.
Alone. Oh my God. Yeah, I
The
just realized
connections,
it.
man.
Oh well. But and it's a, like a, it's a film after a lot of acclaimed Scorsese films. So it kind of seems like a first film, in a sense of the known actors or unknown actors and the story being very grounded, sort of in New York. It feels
Well,
like
the
an
interesting thing
independent
is,
short film
yeah.
made by a first-time director.
Well, the interesting
And
thing is,
it's
he was
not.
the one who made a known actor such as Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci, known. Because, he was at the very beginning with them, with movies such as Mean Streets and then progressively with Raging Bull. But this one is a kind of, it's the established Marty going back to a position where he's working with, I
Yeah,
presume, not so
no,
known
that's what I
actors or
meant,
more on the
because it's
periphery.
after
Yeah.
Raging Bull, it's after Mean Streets, it's
Yeah.
after what else? Taxi Driver, and probably after
Yeah,
as
Taxi
well.
Driver, definitely. Yeah,
So yeah, it's
70s. New
interesting to
York,
see
New
as
York.
yeah.
New York, New York.
Ah, yeah.
The film that led him to depression and cocaine.
Cocaine
Yeah,
and
Robert
bread.
De Niro had to help him get out of that. Because it was a box office flop, New York, New York, and he felt horrible about it. So yeah, that was a dark period in his life.
I mean,
Yeah,
I don't
so
know.
that's it.
I mean, he had made pretty successful films. Then he had a minor flop. Okay. Then he takes
It
cocaine. I
happens.
mean, I think he
Now,
wanted to take
that's the
cocaine.
words
Let's
of the
face it.
man.
But no,
Yeah. That's an
I don't think
excuse,
that's the
Marty.
time for it. He's always done cocaine. I think that's like a thing
Yeah,
about
probably. Yes,
Marty
yes, yes.
that is pretty well. I
Okay,
mean, those
this is the
guys in
time
the
I'm upping the
70s.
dose. Okay.
Yeah, of course. Maybe not underline so much the cocaine, but that, yes, it was an unhappy or unfortunate period for him because he imagined the film to go one way. It didn't go. Yes, he has made a statement towards that. So,
No, yeah, I believe it.
It is a film that pretty much feels like a very enjoy, a very
Fun
like
ride.
fun ride of a short film. It's like a Martin Scorsese short film that is not a short film. I always feel like it's very short, like a little short story, so to speak, for a filmmaker. But it's not. It's a 1 hour and a half
Because it's
movie.
all in one night, so it kind of feels
Yeah,
like
it's only 1 night.
very, very
And
breezy.
this film reminds me of other films, but I just can't name them. I mean, but this clearly is something else I've seen, where you have this guy going through all these weird circumstances, and
A
everything
very
goes wrong.
clear example, although posterior, is Naked from Mike Lee, for example.
I haven't seen that one.
It's like it's also about this tramp portrayed by David Thewlis, who just goes around London but terrorizing people with his intellectual self, just on long speeches about I don't know, just society, capitalism, all that stuff. But it's a different register, but it is very much one night thing and different episodes, and this kind of anxiety-fueled episodes of rage. It is a point. There might be other films, yes, that would
No,
connect it
I'm
to
sure there are, because it's very familiar to me, this narrative.
I was just, I remember one now. There's Repo Man, kind of reminds me of it, that feeling. I mean, in the beginning, in the office, kind of reminds me of Fight Club as well, because of the color, very green,
Yeah.
and
If I
some
have
of the
to say,
tones.
I think the worst thing for me in this film is the second shot. Because the
The
first
what?
one, yeah, because the first one is great. It's this
It's like a push
sort
in,
of
like.
push-in traveling
Yeah. Tracking
thing
shot
where,
real fast.
yeah,
Yeah.
like in a diagonal. Great. Really well done. And then the second shot, it's like this really weird, unnecessary sort of movement towards the computer. You guys have to rewatch it. I really don't think
Right.
it works together with the first one. Because the first one is so dynamic, and then it stops and kind of. I don't know, I felt like it asked for a second shot to be still. And then the second one brings more dynamic, but it's kind of a slower dynamic. I don't know, I thought, whoa, second
I
shot and
see.
it's this. No.
Yeah,
But then
but
everything
speaking
else
of
was
shots,
perfect.
there are beautiful shots in this film. There's one I really like, which is in the conversation he's having with Marcy over the phone, arranging their first real date after their first meet. And there's this really, like, sensual suggestion of the voice on the phone. And there's this traveling process of seeing his mouth over the phone as the camera goes up to that point, to a second point over his ear. You see kind of the voices intermingling over this device, going from here to here, and how it affects his, well, his audition, his ear, you know, her voice on his mind. And then suddenly he says, "I think you should come over, Paul." What? And I was like, something clicks in his brain, and he looks, and then there's a fast cut to the clock, and he thinks he can make it, and he goes very fast. There's a lot of beautiful moments with, you know, the very well-known fast tracking shots or fast traveling push-in shots of Martin Scorsese, two points of interest or objective of interest that then the protagonist has an interaction with, has in cell, you know, phones that he goes and picks up to kind of have a conversation to get out of the rain or whatever.
Yeah, and there are also the taxi shots, like a sort of fast motion that really kind of makes you think that, yeah, it's another thing that's absurd about film, like clearly cartoonish.
And that's absurd about New York. That's a New York cab
Yeah,
driver
I
right
mean,
there.
it's sort of,
Martin
yeah, New
Scorsese, I
York,
think,
but
talks
in
about that, and he
general,
says,
cab
like, yeah.
drivers, sometimes
Yeah.
cab drivers are just insane in the way they drive. It's like, gotta go fast, gotta go fast, gotta get there fast. It's like, relax, man, I want to be
Yeah.
alive.
Which is ironic because they make more money if it takes more time, isn't it? It's like,
Yeah.
it depends.
I don't know
Sometimes they want to
how he does.
prove how good they are, and like, I'm not trying to rip you off, man. I'm gonna take you there as fast as I can. It's like, all
I'm good
right,
at my job.
I'm
And
good. There's also a very cool shot, like a God's eye, when Paul becomes sort of kind of has this breakdown where, why can't I go home? And he again screams to the skies. Kind of remind me of that Shawshank Redemption shot. Obviously, Exactly.
came afterwards, but it seems like an inspiration. I mean, there are others like it, but since the reaction is so similar, it's.
Yeah, it's a because it's raining. I think it's raining, maybe. I
Yeah,
don't
I think
remember.
so, yeah.
In my head, it's raining, but maybe it's because
I
of
mean, he spent
Shawshank.
so much time wet and dry again and wet again that probably there wasn't raining, but because he was wet, you think there
Yeah,
was raining and
probably. No,
things
but it
like that.
definitely rained at some
Was?
points.
Okay.
Because he was talking about it with some character.
And then what else? There's a vigilante mob. That's a classic thing that
And then
happens.
John Hurt is all like, I'm defending you. Yeah, I'm gonna see what it is. Then he goes talk to Catherine O'Hara. Yeah, he's over there. It's like completely sells him out.
Yeah.
It's a solid, funny film. Very good. But that's why I don't really, it's not my favorite Scorsese, because I don't know, I don't feel it the same way I feel other films of his. There's something in here. Feels more like a fun film that he made to, you know, unwind a
Like an
little bit from
interlude.
all the, yeah, like an interlude, like, okay, just made Raging Bull, let's, okay, relax a little.
Yeah, because then there's just other movies that present other worlds that you can almost say that because he has become so, not that this movie isn't like very well crafted and made and it's a great film, but you know, it's almost like by working on the themes of those other films, the three different strands, the gangsters, you know, the lone wolf and whatnot, he has perfected what he can do in those. Like you watch Casino, you know the whole history behind Casino with Goodfellas, you know, and whatnot. That kind of line of narrative, that world that he lives in, you know, when he comes to Casino or later on in other gangster movies, it just feel a whole history behind it that validates that film for you to be your favorite. For example, let's say like Casino is amongst my favorite, if not my favorite gangster film of his. So After Hours really lives in its own bubble by being like the sole one that is a dark comedy, I think. You know, I can really. It was the beginning. It didn't elevate from there. So I don't know. It's a break movie. It's you know, it's a coffee break movie. Let's say that's how I feel. Not to say it's less. It's like it's what you said, unwind, and it's great. It's a great film.
And that's all for today. If you'd like to reach out and suggest a film for the next episode, you can find us on the podcast official Instagram and Facebook pages. Feel free to subscribe, share this episode, or simply give us a little like or a big like.
Ooh.
That's how our podcast can grow ever groovier. And if you're on YouTube and want to see more videos like this, check out this next one right here. Thanks for listening and see you next time.